Father David Hovig, just a brief question. What are your thoughts about having a spiritual father guide you through this reading as opposed to self-direction?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, the texts themselves emphasize repeatedly from the outset that, you know, you should have a spiritual father. And Nikephoros, the first text, but if you don't, do exactly what I tell you. So the texts do themselves teach the need for a spiritual father, but they also understand that not everybody has one, right? So there is a provision for that. I would say, I mean, the kinds of metaphors that we use to describe things are significant, right? They're not arbitrary, but they condition and color the way we think about things. So if I'm in a relationship with a person that I call my spiritual father, well, that makes me the son now, and that sets up a very particular kind of dynamic, let's say. What I've noticed is that most of the writers in the Philokalia, they use words like teacher, didaskalos, and also guide, odigos. Those are different metaphors now, aren't they? Right? You have one relationship to a father, another one to a teacher, another one to a guide. To me, that's good because it opens it up a little bit. I think sometimes the paternal can become the paternalistic, which can end up infantilizing and limiting people to an unhealthy dependence on the guru, right, or the spiritual father. So some of us might be unhappy with that language, but nobody would say that if they were going into uncharted territory, they wouldn't need a guide. So in answer to the question, I mean, if we're about to embark on a journey and we don't know where we're going, we don't know what's around the corner. We're going to cross the sea on our frail little vessel, and we don't know where the whirlpools are, or the shoals, or the pirates, or the right. Okay, it would be very, very wise to have with us an experienced guide who knows the lay of the land. Now, I think Christians who people who are on a spiritual path should have a guide, a teacher, a father, someone who knows just a little more than they do, because otherwise there can be. So that's just a general rule. I think, though, that most of us are going to be, I don't know if this is the best word, but it's the one that comes to mind, most of us are going to be casual practitioners of the Jesus Prayer. While sitting in our car in traffic, while stuck on a line somewhere, or while going into a meeting, or waiting in His Eminence's office for an important meeting, all right? Right? I mean, a lot of these warnings that you hear are intended for people who say the Jesus Prayer, what, 8 hours a day? I really don't think that any of us are going to be, and no one goes from 0 to 8 hours a day on the Jesus Prayer anyway. That's something that takes, that's something you can only do in a monastery, where the conditions are set up for that kind, to support that kind of a practice. We don't live in a world that's set up to enable us to pray. That's why I spoke about all those distractions. It's doing everything it can to prevent us from praying, right? It's keeping us away from the heart and even from the real mind. So I think for most of us who are, as I said, going to be, it's not the best word, but you know what I mean, casual practitioners of the Jesus Prayer, I don't think we should be frightening people by saying, oh, you better not do that without a spiritual father, or, you know, you could go crazy if you, I mean, it angers me when I hear these kinds of things. Who has the right to tell someone not to pray? Who has the right to frighten somebody about prayer? Who has the right to say that invoking the name of Jesus Christ is not safe or dangerous? I think we need to encourage people to say the Jesus Prayer as much as we can, knowing that, you know, I mean, if knowing that they're going to be all right. I mean, if someone has a problem because of it, chances are they already had a problem, and the Jesus Prayer for them was something that. So I wouldn't. If anybody, I don't know what becomes delusional or falls into some sort of, I mean, I don't know what. That wasn't the fault of the Jesus Prayer. I don't know of anybody who, of any reasonably healthy, rational person who embarked on a spiritual path with focus on the Jesus Prayer, went crazy? I don't know of anybody like that. There are people, though, who are mentally, I mean, unstable in certain ways, and for whom, you know, they would need to be watched. But that's not the rule, right? That's not the rule. But I think if someone is going to devote, I mean, intense, concentrated hours on a practice like the Jesus Prayer, they will need spiritual direction. Why? Because they are going to encounter every demon they have inside themselves, every dark thought, right? And the devil, of course, will attack them, right? And if you haven't experienced that sort of thing, well, that can be terrifying. And there can be dreams, there can be all kinds of, right? You need someone to say, okay, listen, this is perfectly normal, right? Oh, unless you understand that it isn't, right? So anyone who's going to go deep like that is going to encounter things down there, right, in the depths, and will need support, will need, because, you know, you might think you're going crazy. What are these thoughts in my head? What's going on? Many people who practice the Jesus Prayer have never actually, are not even aware of the fact that they have thoughts, right? Or because they're always distracted, right? So guides are important, but depending on the nature of the practice, I think, this is why St. Nicodemus says that it's for men, women, educated, uneducated, children. The Jesus Prayer is for everybody, so.
Father Minos from St. Michael in Venice. Is the Philokalia only for monastics, or it can be read by laymen or married priests? Because when I was at St. Tikhon Seminary, my spiritual father, Father Gregory, I asked him about the Philokalia. He said, that's not a book for you. You're not at that stage yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if that's what you're... Was that said to you in particular? Or to the whole group there?
Usually he said this to a lot of his spiritual children.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was his approach, and maybe that was the best thing for those individuals. But the tradition of the church does not restrict... Well, let's say the practice of the Jesus Prayer is one thing, and the Philokalia is something else. I doubt that, you know, volume 2 of the Philokalia contains mostly the writings by St. Maximus the Confessor, which are, for the most part, impenetrable. I mean, even people who specialize in patristic literature have a very difficult time, right, reading through St. Maximus the Confessor. That's not something you're going to give to. I would say, I tell my students that, no, you're not, you know, you can't read this. And of course they get insulted and they think you're demeaning them, and then they want to read it now. And, you know, it's the old advertising principle, right? Tell them they can't have it and they'll want it, right? So, but it is true that some of these texts are, Maximus in particular is a very high difficulty. And it's probably best that, you know, lay people, it's just, they don't need to read that. They need to read something else. But in terms of the syllabus that I've outlined here, in other words, this the practice of the Jesus Prayer, I would never say that that is not something that lay people should practice. If you read St. Nicodemus' introduction, he makes extensive arguments about this. He says all of the fathers of the church, all of the saints of the church taught the Jesus Prayer to everyone. He's convinced of that. He says the same thing. And he was a strict, austere, Athenite monk, right? Going back much earlier, and St. Nicodemus actually quotes this, during St. Gregory Palamas' lifetime, because Gregory Palamas was also a teacher of the Jesus Prayer to everyone, and he ran into trouble with an elderly hermit on the Holy Mountain. This is before St. Gregory became the Archbishop of Thessalonica. He's on Mount Athos. There's an old hermit there who had a reputation for asceticism and whatnot, and he didn't like the idea that St. Gregory was teaching the Jesus Prayer to everybody, and he reprimanded St. Gregory in public about this. Said, you're wrong, and you shouldn't be teaching this, and so on and so on. So that night, this ascetic, I think his name was Job, he goes to sleep and he has a dream, and an angel appears in his dream, and the angel is reprimanding him, or scolding him, saying, you were completely mistaken, and you did a terrible thing by contradicting that holy man, because what he says is correct and true, and you're wrong. And I think the angel started to beat him, right? And he woke up in the middle of the night, and, you know, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Then the next day, right, so he was a strict individual, but he was also a genuine and a humble person, because he went back the next day to St. Gregory and to that same group of people that he had spoken in front of, and he publicly, he told the story, and he acknowledged that he was wrong, right? So from even from the hesychastic period, the practice of the Jesus Prayer was universal. Gregory Palamas's father was a member of the Imperial Senate, and he was a layman and an aristocrat and a politician. He was also a practicer or a practitioner of the Jesus Prayer. And there are stories about him being taken up, sitting in the parliament, the Byzantine Senate, and being sort of caught up in ecstasy because he was saying the prayer. And one of the emperor's men sees, because his advice was important. They said, well, Andronicus, I think his name was, I forget what his name was. The Andronicus was the emperor. He says, well, so-and-so is drifted off again. Should we wake him up? He goes, no, leave him, because it's better that we have somebody here praying, right? So we have stories even of, not just of simple lay folk, but of high-ranking people in politics who were avid practitioners of the Jesus Prayer. So it bothers me when I hear just giving people the Philokalia and saying, here, go home and read it. I mean, that's not advisable, right? But to teach people the practice of the Jesus Prayer, I think is good. And I think that we have an obligation and a calling to become men of prayer and to become teachers of prayer, largely based on our own experience of it. So that's my understanding. I mean, Your Eminence, if you think differently, please feel free to. So,
one tradition they had at the seminary was we used to gather on Friday nights with the monks in the chapel, and we each took the turns and say the Jesus Prayer. And it was very powerful and very spiritual. So maybe we should practice this in parishes, especially there in Greyland.
Well, I mean, I'm not so sure. I wouldn't be in a rush to do something like that, because other things can come from it. But the practice that you describe, sort of the group recitation of the Jesus Prayer, is practiced on the Holy Mountain in very small houses where you might have two or three or four people, or more, like a skeet. And it might be after dinner, and there are string beans that need to be cleaned, people sit around and someone says the Jesus Prayer, or in some other kind of context like that. As a rule, though, that is not the case in the larger community monasteries. Where the Jesus Prayer is restricted to your cell. That's part of your prayer rule. You do not, for the most part on the Mount Athos, I mean, as a rule, you do not walk around in the monastery saying the Jesus Prayer. That's considered not only prideful, but annoying, right? There's a story from that the Jesus Prayer is your intimate communion and dialogue, your relationship of intimacy with God, and it requires a kind of an intimate setting, right? So there's a great story from the monastery of Lohiadir, where they have a very strict abbot, and there's a story about a visitor who goes to the monastery, and he greets the first monk that he sees, and he's horrified by what the monk tells him, and he runs to the abbot. He says, Abbot, he says, I just got to the monastery, and I bumped into a monk in the courtyard, and I asked for his blessing, and I couldn't believe what he told me. I was scandalized. The abbot says, well, what did he say? Well, instead of saying, the Lord bless you, or Panagia bless you, he said, forgive me, he said, for I am a fornicator. And the abbot broke out into this uproarious laughter. And now the visitor was more confused than ever, right? He said, what kind of a monastery is this? He says, oh, he goes, that guy? He goes, don't worry about him. He says, that guy came here, the monk, that guy came here, and he thought he was going to spend the whole day walking around the monastery saying the Jesus Prayer out loud, mumbling the Jesus Prayer all the time, day and night. And he ended up annoying everybody. And I said, hey, you, come here. If you want something to say all day, say this. Forgive me, I'm a fornicator, right? Right? So, which says a lot about this man, that he was obedient and, right? But at Lohiadir, they're very strict, and if you show up late, for example, to the refectory, you sit at a special table with a sign on it that says, Irathimundes, which means sort of the lazy ones. So they, that's unusual. We don't normally do that kind of public shaming of people, but in that monastery there, I don't know if people are traumatized by that, but it's just one of the things that they do. So, okay.